there is an opinion that would permit offering up a Korban Pesach even Bezman Hazeh. And you'll say, but look, all Israel is Tomei right now. So the answer is that at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, if Rov HaOm, the majority of the people were Tomei, then we have a klal that says Tumo Hutro B'tzibur, that in other words Tumo becomes permitted if, you know, the majority of the people are in that state of Tumo. So I mean, it's the broad classification. So that being the case, then a case could be made, you know, for offering up a Korban Pesach Bezman Hazeh, even though we're all in a state of Tumo. But as I say, it's a theoretical case. In reality, nobody, I mean, while it's been proposed from the point of view of theory, but in practice, needless to say, it's never been carried out. Pardon me? Well, I suppose it could be slaughtered on the Harabayas, after all. I mean, but the Korban Pesach can only be brought. Yeah, but it'll only be brought on the Harabayas over there.
Does anyone make the argument?
So I say it's only a theoretical discussion. I mean, needless to say, from the point of view of practicality, no one has suggested that therefore we should all go ahead and shaft the Korban Pesach.
Yeah. Yeah.
This will be my last. Does anyone bring up the argument that over the course of 20 centuries since Herod, that there have been accumulated, well, with the Byzantines and the Aravim, maybe 90 to 150 feet of debris over what was the Beit HaMikdash, and that therefore, since we couldn't possibly be stepping on the Beit HaMikdash, we should be allowed to go there?
Well, as I say, Arav Goren Olav Hasholem, he felt, that he could figure out more or less, what were the original boundaries of the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore he felt that Jews should go up in the Harabayas in those areas where it was not actually the Beis HaMikdash. Now, getting back to what you just said, one of the most interesting things, if you go to Yerushalayim today, is to go on this tour which is sponsored by the Atarot HaKohanim. The Teres Kohanim Yeshiva is a yeshiva which is in the old city. They've been there, and they live side by side, cheek by cheek, together with the Arabs over there, and they managed to get along pretty well with them. And they purposely have their building, within the old city, right next to the Har Habayis, and the course of study also includes that the Kohanim should be studying the various masechtas, that deal with the Beis HaMikdash and the various sacrifices and the temple rituals and everything else, so that if the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt, they're ready to step in. Now, they have a tour that they sponsored, and you go into a newly, widened tunnel that exists underneath the Kotel HaMaaravi. And there, when you go in, you see that in reality it has been built high. Originally the pavement was much lower down, so that would make the walls even higher back in the days of the Beis HaMikdash. You see the various layers, and you can see layers that go back not only through Roman times and Herod's times, but even towards the very end, where you come to a very rocky area over there. This goes back yet to the days of Shlomo HaMelech, to the original Beis HaMikdash. So if you get to Yerushalayim, I would urge, by all means, go and take that trip, take that tour. It's a walking tour, and go underneath, the tunnel that leads underneath the Kotel HaMaravi.
And the people sponsored it are
the Atarot Kohanim Yeshiva,
Yeshiva.
And you give them a donation. You don't to hate. I was very happy to send
them.
They
also have this archaeological seminar towards Aron Rehov Chabad. They're English speaking. English speaking. They also give. They also do it.
It's possible. I don't know that Atera Tohanim has a monopoly on it, but that's certainly one of the sponsors.
Where's the entrance to that tunnel? Where's the tunnel?
You start right where the plaza is of the Kotel Maradi. Yeah. You meet first, then you pay for your ticket over there. Ten shkalim is what it costs. Huh? Yes. And then they take you over there. They don't let you in unless you go with a guided tour.
Yeah. You know where you go into that alcove, right? There's like an alcove that's shaded.
Here's that.
Okay, there's Western Wall. Right? Then you go a little bit to the left, and
it's
really
on the
shade. It's inside. There's a wall covering it. And there are many Hasidim there. And this is about
the
whole area is maybe the size of where we are. And at the end of it, there's like this iron door, if you will, about 20 feet wide. And there's usually some guard there.
Correct.
And
they're always guards.
Then when you're with the tour, they open it. And then you walk through this, and it's really amazing because some of the stones are, there's one stone that's, I think they say it weighs 9,000 pounds. I mean, it's like, it's just bigger than the
It's
table.
Really one of the great wonders how they built it with these tremendous stones.
It's much bigger than what you see
on without iron tools.
Right.
Yeah, they're huge.
Well, that wall, they could use iron tools.
Yeah,
it was
spared.
They're allowed to use it.
But this
I thought
one
they
is
couldn't
like,
use iron tools for any part of the town.
22 feet long or something.
Specifically, towards this, about the Mizbeach.
Oh, do it to Mizbeach.
Those are built by the Turks. Those weren't built by the Romans. That's when the Turks later on tried to make it a little bit bigger.
He was more careful about that because
the Romans were so precise.
Well,
I mean, the Romans, during the Roman era.
It's written over there that
Makabot,
the Garzen,
and the Turks, it's just like they took,
hammers,
stones,
axes, both Lee Barzell, any iron tool, Lo Nishma, Babayat, even was not heard, you couldn't hear it. What they did is, in order to view out the stones that they were to use, they had to do it outside the base of Mekki, then bring it in.
They used the shamir.
The shamir.
The shamir.
Shamir broke it up.
The shamir spawned all the stones for them, right? No.
Right. But I'm telling you what it says, right? Yeah, that's what I got into that thing, right?
We really got a question.
Yeah.
Sure, you had a question, but the blocks of stone for the Kotel Maharavi.
Yeah.
Were they quarried in Eretz Yisrael or were they also quarried in Lebanon?
Quarried in Eretz Yisrael, absolutely.
Trees.
They were seen, they floated down in the
They mentioned that it took them 2 years to
quarry
up there.
Okay. Correct. But not the stones. The stones were quarried outside of the Yerushalayim. Okay, but what they did float down from Lebanon was the trees. You know, the cedar trees that they used, the arazim. That they made them into rafts and they floated them down from from Tzor and Sidon over there. Yes, of course. Yes. Okay. But in the building of it, the wonder about Shlomo HaMelech is that everything was prepared outside so that within the building itself there would not be any iron or axe or hatchet. Right. Yeah, okay.
And with Herod, all the stone was surrounding Yerushalayim.
Right. Of course not. So what are they going to do? They're going to schlep heavy stones from Lebanon? Of course not. But the timber they brought. Right. Well, there was, but they wanted specifically the arazim, They wanted the cedars, because the cedars were very very good for building. Obviously, you can see, they stood for how many hundreds of years?
Thousands.
Well, it was spread by the Babylonians, but then they rebuilt. But, until the time that the Babylonians destroyed it, it was in existence for close to 500 years. Okay, getting back to our text. Anyway, we're about 6-7 lines from the bottom over there. All right. Yeah, Rabbi Yochanan, he says the Tame. Right. Rabbi Yochanan is consistent with his reasoning, the Omar Kro, because he says, the Torah says to Moshe, as we said before, he applied that to Gezeirah Shavah. And it says, V'chi k'sir t'motsoi, and obviously, according to Rabbi Yochanan, if it says, you know, that if he eats of anything which is Kodesh, right, mm-hmm. and he's still in the state of uncleanliness, so la'acha zriko hu d'chsiv, then this has to be applied only after the blood has already been sprinkled upon the Mizbeach. In other words, according to Rabbi Yochanan's point of view, when does the meat of the sacrifice actually become Kodesh? It's not with the Shechita, in other words. Because remember, what happens? First you have to shecht it. And then what is the next step?
The blood.
Right, you have to receive the blood. Right? The Kohen takes a kli, you know, he takes a vessel and he gathers the blood. And then, what does he have to do? He has to, right, has to pour it on the Mizbech, sprinkle it, pour it, whatever you want to call it. I mean, because, you know, that would depend upon
what he was doing.
Zriko means literally, you know, that he throws it on the altar. Why does it say throw? Because in some cases he has to throw it upon the four corners, and in some cases he throws it only on two opposite corners, but, you know, to make sure at the time that he throws the blood over there that it's a little on each of the sides of the Mizbech. That would depend on the individual sacrifice, what the Lord's were, okay?
When did he pour the
remaining
prophets?
Pardon me?
Prophets.
That was only on Yom Kippur.
Only on Yom Kippur.
And the remaining, though, he poured
that
on
was
the...
And the rest they had to pour down at the foundation. They had, you know, either it sank into the ground, or there was maybe even a conduit underneath.
Yeah, ran it off.
Which ran off, right. Correct. That's when it officially becomes Kodesh. This is his point of view, okay? And of course, Reish Lakish disagreed with him. This is why Reish Lakish says touching itself is already prohibited, whereas Rabbi Yochanan would say that it's not really the touching that's the bad thing, but is the eating of it. And naturally, when does it first become fit for eating? Only after the Kohen has first sprinkled the blood upon the Mizbeach. Then it becomes sacred meat that you know, the person who brings the Shlomim or the Torah can eat. Yeah, absolutely, no question, at all times. I mean, even for the moment of Shechita, it should also be the intention that you have in mind, you know, that the sacrifice that you're performing is in accordance with the, you know, what is it being brought for. Okay. Yeah. Right, well, pickle, we learned, this applies that if you decide, I mean, that, for example, you're going to eat it either someplace other than in the Beis HaMikdash, which is prohibited, or to eat it after the time when it's already prohibited to eat. And that we learned, you know, again, if you take a look at Ezeu Mekomon, you'll see that depending upon the sacrifice, there are certain time limits prescribed. For example, the Korban Pesach, we know, can only be eaten that night until midnight.
Midnight.
All right, granted you that we learned in Brachas that in reality, you know, it could be eaten after midnight, but we don't bask it that way. I mean, according to Rabbi Gamliel, it says, mitzvot kol ha'layla, right? Ad honei tzachama, this is what he said. In other words, until the time that day breaks, right? But why? Why did they say, you know, that it has to be only up until Ad Chatzot? The answer is, we want to make sure that people are not going to come and transgress by giving them more time. You give more time, the people take more time, you see. So that, therefore, it must be only up to Chatzot, only up to midnight, okay? And we have others where, for example, it has to be eaten on the day, b'yom zivchachem yeochel, right? And that very night, and that's it. Anything that's left over to the following morning has to be burned. In other cases, it's b'yom zivchachem yeochel umimocharas, and may be eaten that day and the following day. So this is what they call, you know, yom v'layla. In other words, you have a day and you have a night, and then you can go through the following day, or the yom v'layla mainly means only until the following morning. You know, as I say, you have to look at the individual sacrifice to see what it says specifically. Of course, it's all based on sukkah, you see. But if you have the intention of eating it other than at the time that the Torah says you're allowed to eat it, then that already throws it out. I mean, it makes it pigol, no good. Piggy out.
Say the word again.
Yeah. Pigol.
Pigol.
Pigol, right. Pei gimel vav lamed, right, pigol. And the verb is mafagel.
You know, they use that in a commercial sense. If a check or bill of exchange is overdue, it's pigol.
Right, that's the origin.
It's the same idea.
That's the origin,
It's already beyond the...
Right, beyond the time that it should have been taken care of. Exactly.
Is also a time
Pardon me?
No sar?
Yeah, well, no sar means that it's left over when it should have been finished. So anything which is left over has to be burned. Yeah, that's no sar. Naturally, if a person needs no sar, needless to say, it's, you know, he gets kares for that. We'll also get Malkus.
Malkus.
Give Malkus.
Malkus is also for us.
It could be. Not necessarily, though. Okay? Question is also, you see, with no sar, you are violating it by still keeping it around after the time has already been prescribed. But this is a case of what we call lav hanitok la'aseh. In other words, it's a lo saseh, but you can rectify it by then doing what the Torah says. What does the Torah say in the case of Noah? It says, "Vayesh disrofu." Okay, you have to burn it. So, we have learned the general rule, and this will go back again to this business, that if you have a lav, Nitok le'aseh, in other words, a lo saseh, where the punishment should have been malchus for violation, but you have something to rectify it, in this case by burning it, then in that case you don't get malchus for it. Lav
nitkan al yedin.
Nitak.
Nitak.
Right. It's connected to.
Right.
Right. It's tied over into or something like that. You see. Lav and ase, in other words.
Right.
You have a negative commandment, you have a positive or affirmative commandment, as I prefer to call it. Okay? So for that, you know, you don't get malchus because you have rectified what you did wrong.
Yeah,
okay?
It's like a tzakah.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. All right.
Where are we?
Okay. The Omar quote to Moshe, the one who can see it to Moshe, the Chazwika who did see it. Right. All right. So he says, "Ahim bechol kodesh nafka." Says this. He derives from bechol kodesh leisifka, and then it says, "Tanya kavosi the Reish Lakish." We have learned a statement which is in agreement with Reish Lakish, namely when he says bechol kodesh leisiga, he says ashora leochel. He says that the fact that the Torah says lo siga, you shouldn't touch, this also warns us against eating, according to Reish Lakish, because Reish Lakish stresses the touching.
Right.
But after all, it doesn't mean that therefore touch, but it's okay to eat without touching it. Because the answer is no.
Gobble it
so
up.
He says, right, the warning not to eat is already, in, you know, it's fine, contained fine. Where it says don't touch, you see. You say that this is a warning for eating. Maybe it's only a warning for touching. So Talmud Leimar, that's why it says, Bechol Kodesh Lo Siga, and not to touch anything which is holy, V'yela Migdosh Le Sobo, as I said, which is the continuation of the Pasuk. So, right. So that if it says, and into the sanctuary, you're not allowed to enter in the state of Tumah. So he says, Makish Kodesh Lemikdosh. He makes a comparison between eating holy meat and the Beis HaMikdosh. Ma Mikdosh, just as if a person is unclean and he comes into the Beis HaMikdosh, and this is Dover Sheyeshbo Netilas Leshoma, this is an action where the punishment will be the taking of the soul, in other words, for Kores, right? So, Af Kol Dovar, Sheyesh bo netilas neshama, right? So this also then, according to Reish Lakish, applies to anything wherein kores would be the punishment of Av, literally the taking the soul. The e binagia me ika netilas neshama. So then they ask the kasha. So tell me, just touching it alone, you say that this is going to involve kores, taking the soul, elaba achila. In other words, where is a real violation which will be punished with kores? That would only be for eating. Okay? Omar Rabba Barachana. So Rabba Barachana says, Omar Rabbi Yochanan, the name of Rabbi Yochanan, he says, Kol lo sa'aseh. Any time where you have a negative commandment, says, don't do this. She kidomo aseh. And it is preceded by an affirmative action. So what would happen if you violate it? Then in that case, he says, lo kinelo. Then in that case, you're going to get malchus. Now notice the order in which this comes. We said just a few moments ago that you have a lav,
right?
A nitak la'ase, right? In other words, you have a negative violation of a negative prohibition, right? And then you rectify it by an affirmative action, right? And the affirmative action already cancels out the malchus.
Burning?
Huh?
Burning.
What burning? In the case of no sir, yeah, but there could
it
be other actions.
To contradict this.
I mean, if, for example, somebody steals. All right, somebody steals. Is it a violation? Yes. Can it be rectified? Sure. Make good what you stole. So that rectifies. So that therefore, if a person, you know, does that, then in that case, he's not going to get malchus. Okay. But the order is, first of all, you violated a negative commandment, and then after that, you rectify it. But what if you have, according to Rabbi Yochanan, first an affirmative commandment, okay, and then you have a negative commandment? Then in that case, if you have violated the affirmative commandment, this is the point he's making, if you violated the affirmative commandment, you get malchus for that, not just for the negative. Get it for the affirmative one. Okay?
Right, and there's the shekadmo, in other words, the affirmative is before the negative.
Right, right. Let's take a look at the Rashi. We'll give us an example of that. Okay? All right, this is the fifth line from the bottom, towards the end over there. See, kol lo sa'aseh shekdomo as.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, sure.
Lokan alok. Says ho also lashmina, says Rashi, this has come in order to teach us the afilu, that even lamando omar lav hanidak la'ase and lokinalov, right? That you know, according to the opinion that says that if you have a negative commandment and then it's rectified, you know, by an affirmative commandment, you don't get malchus. Kidetanya, as we have learned, and the case that I mentioned before, los asiru, right? You're not allowed to leave over from the sacrifice, right? But after that, what does it say? Vanosor tisrefu, right? But if you have no sor, then in that case you burn it, right? So bo hakosuv, right? The Torah then comes litain asay achalos asay, right? To mention, you know, an affirmative action that you can do after you have violated a negative one. Lomar, to tell you, she'en lokin ulov, that you don't get malchus if you rectify it, okay? She'nitak hakosov is a asek neyos onshol shalav, okay? Because what has happened is that the Torah has taken the affirmative commandment to say that this takes the place of the punishment of the violation of the law, the tikuno, and it's to tell us that this is how you rectify it. Okay, lomar, in order to tell us, lo sa'aseh kach, right? Don't do this, such and such. V'yimotziso, but if you have, then aseh zos, right? Do this, v'hipoter, and then you will be potter. Potter, of course, from what? Potter from the malchus. Okay. Va'ashmein and Rabbi Yochanan, so along comes Rabbi Yochanan to tell us, Hanimile, this is Ba'asei HaBo'acha HaLav. This is where the affirmative action comes after the negative action. In other words, it's there in order to rectify it. She'en ato yocho lekayimo elo leyacha averas halav, which means that you cannot do the affirmative action to rectify until after you have first violated, right? Avol, however, he says, asei she'kodam as halav, if you have an affirmative action that first, that precedes the negative, v'yato yocho lekayimo, and you are in a position to carry out the affirmative commandment, right? Kodim averus halav, before you go and transgress by committing a lav, a negative commandment, ein zen nituk halav. Then this is not the rectifying of the negative commandment. Va'afilu tekayemenu achar averus halav. And even if you then go back and fulfill the affirmative action after you have transgressed with the negative, right? Lo niftarta b'da malchus, is still not free from getting malchus, because you had a chance to do that which is right and you didn't do it. So that therefore, what should be your punishment? Your punishment should be that you get malchus. Okay. Well, we'll stop at this point and continue from the topic next. Yes, okay.
I thought I understood something. You have the positive commandment precedes the negative.
Correct.
Now,
that's, in this case, what does Rabbi Yochanan say?
Well, what
get
he's
malchus.
Saying is
you
that
get malchus, because you had every possibility to perform an affirmative action and you didn't do it.
That's what I didn't understand.
Right.
It isn't... It is not that you did the positive commandment, but you failed to. Well,
you
I mean,
failed to
you
do
you
the positive.
Did the, you also then did.
And then you went and transgressed it by doing a negative that you weren't supposed to do.
So
he's saying that even if afterwards, this is what Rashi adds, that even if afterwards you then go and you do the affirmative,
it doesn't absolve
you from getting the malchus.
This is where I'm lost.
Right.
Two different ideas.
Right.
First idea is that you do the positive commandment, then you transgress the negative commandment.
He doesn't say you do the positive. This is what he's saying. He says you should have done the positive.
That's the second idea.
Okay.
You should have done the affirmative. But you did
right.
not do it.
You
failed to
do it. Right.
Then you went and you transgressed the negative commandment.
Correct.
Then you would then attempt
the affirmative, right?
To rectify by doing the affirmative.
Correct. So he says you get malchus because this is not the same as saying, you know, that the affirmative comes after the negative and rectifies it. When you had a chance to do the affirmative by itself, even before it became a transgression, by your doing something, you know, that negates it. So in that particular case, you deserve malchus because you violated an affirmative commandment.
That's true.
Which doesn't normally
happen.
I
understand the logic there. You're actually doing two transgressions.
Correct.
You failed to do the affirmative and then you transgress the negative.
That's right.
And by doing the affirmative, actually, you're really only canceling out one.
Correct. I don't say this from the point of view of law that everybody's going to agree with Rabbi Yochanan. You understand? But nevertheless, let's understand what Rabbi Yochanan is trying to say over here.
All right.
So, Yitzhak Hashem, next
we
week
it's
going to be.
We start
at the top of Tesvav Omidalev, right?
Omidalev.
Okay. Yeah.
And it will be.
Yeah, well, let's see.
This is February 28th, 1996.
Right.
Because Purim is March 5th.
It will be March 6th that will be.
The day after the Purim.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Not Shushan Purim. All right. We have been discussing the new subject matter that we have at the top of Tesvav.
Oh.
Omid Aleph. Okay. And in it we saw, in reference to a statement made at the bottom of the previous page, by Rabbi Baba Chona in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we showed you know, that the statement stated that if there is an affirmative command followed by a negative command and you violate the affirmative command to begin with, then in that case you get marbles. This is the statement of Rabbi Yochanan. Then at the top of 15, the question was asked, did he say it? Did you say it? And he says no. In other words, he retracted the statement. And as I discussed, it may be either a question directed to Rabbi Yochanan or maybe a question directed to Rabbi Bar Chanan. Okay? Mm-hmm. The authorities differ as to who is the one. Okay. But at any rate, as the discussion continues, they say, well, wait a minute. There is validity in that statement of Rabbi Yochanan because it's supported both by a pasuk in the Torah and also by you know, a Mishnah, which confirms it. What is the pasuk in the Torah? Pasuk in the Torah says, in reference to the a person who's suffering from leprosy or from gonorrhea, or if he has a seminal emission, that the shalchu min amachta, they have to send him out of the camp. Now, which camp are they talking about? The answer is the camp of the Shechina. Okay? The camp of the Shechina. With the Tzaruah, actually, you throw them out altogether. But with the others, they cannot be in the Machdei Shechina. Okay? In other words, they cannot be where the Yohan Moed is. And, of course, this translates into that they're not allowed to come into the Beis HaMikdash in a state of Tomei, which is what we learned at the beginning of this chapter in the Mishnah. Okay? Right. All right. So, if there is such fine support, the question is, why did he retract? So, the Gemara says he retracted because he had difficulty with the case of the Ones. All right, now what is the case of the Ones? So, I started to explain. We have to take a look in the Torah in Parsha Kisese. There are two different instances mentioned over there. Instance number one was the case of a man where he is married. He takes a dislike to his wife and he wants to get rid of her. Okay? So he comes to the Beis Din and he says, she wasn't a virgin when I married her. Okay? So the parents come and, you know, they protest that they have proof that she was a virgin and so on. And what is the punishment for this man because of the fact that he was Lahotzi Shem Ra? In other words, he made a false accusation against a Jewish maiden. So there are two things that are mentioned over there. It says, first of all, the onshu oso meor kesef, that the court has to fine him 100 silver shekels, which he has to give to the father of his wife, right? And at the same time, there's another injunction. It says, v'lo sieli yisho, she is his wife, she will remain his wife, and lo yuchal shalchol kol yamov. He's not allowed to divorce her all the days of his life. He cannot give her a divorce. He cannot get rid of it that way. Okay? Has to keep her. So that's the first case. And that's the case that we would call Motzi Shemra. Okay? All right. Now, case number two is the one that we find towards the end of that same chapter, which is on page 846, beginning with verse 28. It's the last few psukim, last couple of psukim in chapter 22 of Sefer Devarim. All right, it's written over there. Kigimtzo ish naro besula shelerosa. Okay, a man finds a girl who is a virgin. She has not been betrothed to anyone. In other words, you know, she's what we would call a penuya. She is, you know, she's not engaged to anyone. Okay, because if she were engaged, that would be a possible death sentence. You see. Okay. But in this particular case, it's not a death sentence because she was not engaged to anyone. Utsfoso, he grabs hold of her, v'shochavimo, and he lies with her. In other words, he rapes her. So he rapes her, that's all. We're not talking about seduction, because that's something else. That's called mefate, okay? Mefate, right. Mefate. He seduces her, okay. But this is called ones. In other words, he forced her. Mm-hmm. He raped them. Okay.
Onus. Right. Actually means rape now.
Right. Onus. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Onus.
Yeah. Onus. To
what?
Onane. But it's
no. That's only, no. It's a different word.
Yeah. Onane is with an yeah. I, and this is
no.
With
it is. Onane is also with an olive, but it's
really
a different stem. Yeah.
Oh.
The stem there is Aleph Nun Nun, whereas this is Aleph Nun Samach. So
I take that.
That's a different.
You're right. Root.
Okay. Onais, you say.
Yeah.
Onais.
Yes.
Onais is the verb,
verb
or
right.
the person who does
right.
the action.
Right.
And ones is the noun.
Ones is the.
You know the. The abstract noun for rape. Okay.
Right.
All right. So he's onais. He rapes this girl. Now, what is the punishment in his case? So it's written, V'dosan ha'ish ha'shochev imo la'avi anavro chamishim kosev. This time the Torah says that he has to pay the girl's father 50 shekels. In other words, the monetary is different from the other one. Okay?
The other one's 100 shekels.
Right. But then, look at the next three words. It says, V'lo si'eli isha. She becomes his wife. Okay? Mm-hmm. She shall be his wife. Tachas asherino, because of the fact that he raped her, lo yuchal shalchol kol yamov. Again, the same thing that we
not
had before.
He's
not allowed to divorce her all the days of his life. Okay? So we see then that a case might be established for creating a parallel between the case of the ones and the case of the motzi shemra.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? All right, so this we have to bear in mind now as we take a look at what's going on.
Sure. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
She has to remain his wife for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
Or maybe she hates the man and she wants a divorce. What happens then?
Of course, I think it goes to everyone's mind.
Right, right.
I think
believe me, I thought about that too. But I don't know whether the Bezdin is entitled to go against the law of the Torah in this case. Maybe they'll butcher him to death. I don't know. But it's a problem. I mean, basically, what is the reason? The reason is that they don't want a girl to be thrown out without any support. They want to make sure that he's committed to supporting. Right, of course, the other right
the reputation may be upheld by the Pesach Din.
Right.
Yeah, but
that she's innocent of that. But even so, even if it's upheld, and he's forced to pay the fine, and let's say, then they say, all right, we'll have a gerushin. Right, we'll have a gap, that's it. But then that deprives her
of a good marriage.
Right.
Yeah,
the money anyway is going to her father.
Of Parnassah.
Exactly.
And being a...
She doesn't get the money, David. She doesn't get the money.
That
it's her father, right.
That I understand perfectly. Because the damage to reputation is to him.
Yeah,
as a
to
father,
her and to him, both. Right, exactly. Because she's a reflection on her parents, of course.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But... And also, the money will not last her for the entirety of her life.
Of course.
And how then does she get married? Because she's now no longer a virgin, and this isn't modern day Western world. It's right.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
She'd have to stay married to him.
Yeah. Right.
But it's an interesting thing. Why? You know, it seems like it's a sentence for him.
Because
then, don't forget,
he has another relief.
He also has
to marry another woman too.
he has
to keep her, but
wait, we learned already. Excuse me, we learned in I forget, but it's in Shamot. We learned already.
Yeah.
No, it's not a joke.
Yeah,
we learned already.
Right.
He cannot subtract from her food, her clothing, her conjugal relations.
Correct.
So even though he hates her,
he's
obligated.
Right. He has obligations, absolutely.
Now why?
But
I mean, her life is also miserable. I mean, it's interesting.
But even if he doesn't do those things.
Sounds like a napple in there.
She can't take him to the basement and say, hey, this man is not doing what he's supposed to do. They can't force him to do it.
Yeah.
I never heard of that. I mean, it's not in the...
No, they never discussed that aspect of it. All that is discussed is, you know, what
they don't
even
not
say.
Not even soda, do they discuss something like that? No?
Well, soda is...
So there's a different.
It's
different.
It's brought. Yeah. This would be something brought by the wife, but the petition of Tiyun or Toin brought by Tana, brought by the wife that she doesn't have her
and
right.
In the time of the Talmud, actually, they could do certain things to compel a man to give a woman a divorce.
Correct.
Which we don't follow anymore today, unfortunately, because there were cases where the court that would be wonderful if they could. Compel a person to give again to his wife.
Right.
Because too many guys are taking advantage of
blackmail the wife.
There's nothing in the Talmudic literature of a woman bringing a petition her husband doesn't provide her food, clothing, or sexual relations. There's nothing.
Well, she knows she has every right to go to the Beis Din and demand that these things be.
That's what he asked.
Yeah. No, that's what. Yeah, but what can the Beis Din do about it?
What they can do?
Give him malchus.
They can threaten. Yeah, they can give him malchus.
They can give him malchus.
Okay. You see, you have a certain type of malchus which is not discussed over here, and this is called malchus bardus. Mardus is from the word merit.
Oh, Mardus. Right.
In other words, rebellious. He's rebellious. He refuses to listen to what the Beis Din is telling him that the right conduct is, and so therefore the court can make an example of him by giving him malchus.
Okay.
Mm. Okay? So, it's not necessarily he. I mean, a woman also could be declared.
No,
to be
they do that now today.
Right.
They declare a woman a rebellious wife.
Right. So,
I'm not sure what grounds, but I think it has something to do with unchastity or possibly
if the fact that, you know, that let's say she refuses to accept a gift from her husband or something like that.
Yes, that's
when
that's
it has
true.
Been legitimately executed and so on. And, you know, a due provision has been made for her, for his husband, and everything else, and so on. So there's a possibility. Or, let's say, if a woman decides to become converted to Yoshki or something like that, when her husband, you know, wants to keep a kosher home and raise up his children Jewishly. I mean, there are possibilities. Of course, I'm not saying
what
that today any court is going to do
about
it.
What about promiscuity?
But there was a time when it was.
What about, I'm sorry, we're getting way off, but I mean, what about promiscuity and all these factors? Because they use this business in the Israeli courts in terms of custody of children and rabbinical courts.
Yeah.
A woman can be declared a rebellious wife.
Yeah, she can be declared a moretus if necessary.
For what? Besides the...
Because she refuses to listen to what the Beis Din has decreed or something like that.
I see what you're saying.
All
right. That would be the grounds for it. All right.
But it could be for other reasons, I say. As for example, if she decides to convert to Christianity, let's say, or to Islam or something like that, and when the husband wants to retain a strictly kosher home, bring up the children Jewishly or something like that, so you see there is also in that case she's a moretus, she's a rebellious woman.
That probably is where she refuses to keep her kosher home or something.
So in olden times when the Beis Din had a lot more power, they could inflict malchus bardus to serve as not only a punishment to the person who refuses to listen to the Beis Din, but also to serve as a warning to the community that you have to follow the decrees, let's say, of the court that has sat in judgment, and in their in their honest opinion, they've come up with the following verdict or something.
Is there also a law in the Torah that a divorce can be requested on the basis of the fact that a woman can't have children?
Okay, that's
the
not
man
in the Torah. That is, of course, in the Gemara, where they go into laws in greater detail. There is such a thing that, for example, a woman has not given birth after 10 years of marriage, that the husband may ask if he wants to, he could divorce the wife in the hope that maybe he'll find another woman with whom he can have children, or maybe assuming that he was the fault, so she could, make another life for herself with another man and have children. It could work both ways.
Right.
But
there's no specific law.
Compulsory.
Okay.
It's not compulsory. Right. Famous story is told, about how the man, the woman, they loved each other very, very much. And still, after 10 years of marriage, they had no children. So she said to him, "I know, the law says that you have to divorce me so that you can have." So he says, "Okay," but he says, "I want you to choose whatever it is that you want." So she got him drunk.
Yeah,
and she brought him over to her home. And she says, you're the thing that I want. And God bless them, and eventually they had children.
Oh, then Chana also, how many years did Chana go without children?
Yeah, well, we don't know exactly how many years. But since
her rival
Penina had seven children already, it probably was pretty close to 10 years.
You know, so a woman
right.
comes over and says she can't have children after 5 years of marriage, and offers you, there it goes to the
woman. Well, I never heard of this, but.
Well, that would be up to, both parties, you understand? Divorce can be at any time.
Of course.
Because if we follow, for example, the Torah says, the same area over here, right? That he finds in her something which is literally some kind of lewdness or something like that. Well, Erbas Dover, you know, it doesn't really discuss what it is. So you have two different opinions. The opinion of Beis Shammai and the opinion of Beis Hillel, okay? One opinion is very strict. Okay, and it says that Erbas Dover means literally what it says, nakedness. Nakedness means, in other words, that, you know, adultery, okay?
Right.
So, for adultery, even if you don't have witnesses or something like that, but if you feel, you know, that she has been an adulterous woman, then you can divorce her, okay? But the other opinion says that even if she ruined the food,
Right.
You could divorce her. Tavshila. I mean, she burnt it so that it wasn't fit for human consumption or something.
Really?
You could divorce her.
Yeah,
well,
now
that's
tell
a
me.
Famous.
Yeah.
Now you tell me.
Whether it's so, if you go on that basis, what it means is that you don't necessarily have to prove infidelity as a reason, you see, for it. If the two parties don't get along with each other and they feel they can't live together, then there are grounds then for a divorce.
Right.
And that's not dependent upon any number of years. But getting back to our case over here, here the Torah specifically said, the lo siyeli yeshura, she has to be his wife, and lo yuchal shalchol kol yamav, he's not allowed to divorce her all the days of his life.
Right.
So, we now have a parallel. Okay. So this is what they're trying to say. Okay.
Right.
Says the Shumli Kashale Ones. He says the difficulty is the business of the man who raped the woman. The Tanya, as we have learned, and there's a statement that says Ones, a raper, a rapist, whatever you want to say, Shegeirash, who then divorced the woman into marriage with her,
right.
And then they decide, hey, I've had enough of her, I'm going to divorce her, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So he's violating, of course,
the Torah,
which says what?
You're not allowed.
Not allowed to, right? So what is the punishment? So it says, first of all, Im Yisrael, if he's just an ordinary Israelite, who, right, then Machzir v'yeno loka. Then in that case, he can remarry or take her back, right, in marriage. He remarries her, and he does not get Malkus for the previous violation. Okay? In other words, this is like a case of what? Like Lav Hanita Klase, right? In other words.
What is the middle word that you keep saying? Lav
Hanitak.
Now take us to.
Which?
Yod
Tav Kuf.
Does that
which
mean
means
to it's
bound together. No, which is bound together.
Le not take
means to tie together.
I thought le not take was to cut yourself off, or to cut off. But le heat not take is to withdraw from something, or le not take is to cut off. But here it also means to be bound together.
You're right. I mean that, the way it's understood is understood the way I took it.
Okay fine. No, I'm
right.
Just stirring. Fine.
Right.
It's no problem. As long as I get.
But you're absolutely right that in reality the word today is used more in the opposite sense. It means to break asunder. In other words, lahadeik means to tighten something.
Right, exactly.
And the nateik means, you know, to loosen it, to tear it asunder. Like, for example, lo nutka od hashalshelet. The chain of Jewish tradition has not yet been torn asunder, okay? It's not been broken. So you're right. However, love hanitik lase. In that case, maybe you can take it in the sense that the violation of the love, right, has been loosened by the fact that there is subsequently an ase, you know, which makes it
sure. That's a very
which
good
straightens
way of doing
it out.
Sure.
So maybe that's the way we should take it. Okay, I think that would make better sense. Okay. All right. So, what does it say over there? So it says, if he is a Yisrael, right, he takes back the woman, in other words, in marriage, he remarries her, the Enolok, and he doesn't get Malkus, even though he has violated what? He has violated the law that says, Lo Yuchal Shalcho Kol Yomav, right? He's not allowed to divorce her. But he straightens it out that way. However, in Kohen who? Mm-hmm. What if he is a Kohen? Then Loka, he gets Malkus, the Enu Machzir, and he cannot take her back in marriage. Why can't he take her back in marriage?
Because he's not allowed to wear a divorced woman.
Cohen may not marry a divorced woman. So
you could get good works done.
So his punishment is to get Malkus, right? Okay, Im Yisrael who Machzir the Enu Loka, right? So now the question, you say that if he's an Israelite,
right,
and he takes her back in marriage,
right,
right, and he doesn't get Malkus,
right,
am I? Why shouldn't he? This is getting back now to an analysis of what Yochanan said before, right?
Right.
Why shouldn't he get Malkus? Isn't this, first of all, a lo sa'aseh, they have a negative commandment, shekdomo asehu, which has been preceded by an affirmative command. What is the affirmative command? All right, let's take a look again at the business of the Ones. Okay? All right. So, V'no'asan ha'lishu shavrim mo'la v'yadar ha'chamishim kos. All right, but now, V'lo siyeh le'isho, right? This is the affirmative. She has to be his wife. This is the affirmative.
What page are we on?
Okay, page 846.
All right, right.
Verse 29, right? First comes the statement, Velosia Leisha. She has to be his wife. And then comes the negative.
Right, okay.
Right? Lo Yuchal Shalcho Yom Kol Yomo.
Cannot
allow to divorce her all the days of his life. Okay. So, this is the question. If
right.
this is the case, right, why shouldn't he get Malkus? Why shouldn't he get Malkus?
Seems like pretty good.
Do you swear?
Pretty good argument.
Because if we have a case, first of all, that we have an affirmative, which is says, Velosi Elisha,
right?
Right,
that's the affirmative.
And then it's followed by the negative, then we learn, according to Rabbi Yochanan, that he should get Malkus for that.
Right.
And still we said what? That if he's a Yisrael, he is not going to get Malkus.
Right.
So it's a good question. Why shouldn't he?
Well, we know why he can't. It's a
So Veluka, why should he get Malkus, right?
So
Omar Ula, so Ula comes with an explanation. It says, Lo Yomar Lo Siyeli Isha Be'ones. He says, you know what? We don't even have to have a pasuk as far as the rapist is concerned, which tells us that he has to marry this woman. But Ligmar, we could learn it on the basis of logic from what? Memotzi Shemra. From the previous case that we had discussed, you know, where he casts an evil reputation on the woman by saying, you know, that she wasn't a virgin, right? And what did it say over there?
Same thing, basically.
Yeah, it said basically the same thing. All right, the money was different. But still, there it said specifically what?
It's,
two things. That he has to marry her, right? He can't divorce her.
And he has to pay a fine.
And the other one is that he has to pay a fine, but also, because it's written the onshu oso, okay? There's a difference in language over here. I want to point that out right now. You have to make a little fine analysis at times of how the words are, okay? Look at the Okay, verse 19, compare the word there with what we have in verse 29. There it says, "Vi onshu oso meokesem," which literally means that they are to punish him by assessing this fine of 100 silver pieces, right?
I'm sorry.
And here it says, what? The norsan ho'ish, the man is to give the father. Now, on this basis of a fine analysis, we say that what? That onesh implies already more than simply a monetary fine. Okay? Onesh means that he has to get a little physical punishment as well. In other words, he gets malchus. So in the case of the onesh, we say that, in the case of the Motzi Shemra, the Torah is saying the onshu would imply that he gets malchus in addition to everything else that he has to do. Whereas, in the case of the rapist, right, the ones, there, it doesn't say that they are to punish him. Okay?
It says they give the 50
correct. Right. So, if that's the case, obviously we're not finished with the argument. I mean, because you can say, okay, good, the Israelite should get malchus, but he doesn't get malchus because he takes her back again in marriage. The Kohen, we know, he cannot take her back in marriage, so he gets his malchus. All right. But why shouldn't the Israelite also get malchus? After all, he too violated a command, which is an affirmative command, velosia liyisha, right? At least for him, it's an affirmative command.
What do you mean, the Kohen gets malchus?
Yeah.
The
Kohen gets malchus. Because of the fact that
he can't take her back.
He can't take her back. So he has to be punished for divorcing her when he had no business divorcing her. So he gets malchus as his punishment.
But he
can't remarry her because as a divorcee, he's not allowed to marry her.
Right, but the Israelite marries her. Okay?
Right.
He's also getting punished because he has to live with her for the rest of his life.
True, but it's not the punishment taken out of his hide.
You want to take a piece out of his hide. Okay. I'll go along with that.
Okay. So, all right, why doesn't he get malchus? So, Uma said, okay, lo yomar, Torah doesn't have to say what? Lo si eli yisho biyones, that, you know, no. That she has to be his wife in the case of the rapist. Well, Ligmar, we could have learned it in Motzi Shemra. Right? Bama Motzi Shemra, inasmuch as, look, the Motzi Shemra, the guy who says something bad about his wife, Shelo aso ma'ase, it wasn't a physical thing that he did to his wife. He only killed her reputation.
That could be as bad.
Right.
As bad
but it's
as
only by, of course, remember, we've had this problem before, that if you say something, it's not considered the same as actually doing physical harm to somebody. Yeah, you're harming that person, no question about it. And of course the Torah condemns, you know, anybody who is a Motzi Shemra. But from the point of view of punishment, there was no physical action at that particular case. Okay? So it says, Ma Motzi Shemra, in that case, Shelo aso ma'aseh, he didn't do anything physically to hurt her. Omer Rachmona, and the Torah said in that case, Velo si eli yishua, that he is to marry her, right? So ones, then the case of the rapist, where of course he did physical harm to her. She was a virgin and he made her vice virgin, you know.
Right.
So lo kol shekein. All the more reason that what?
He should get punished.
They should stay with her, right.
That's right, that he has to be married to her, right. Right. So, if that's the case, then why do we have to have, in the case of the, the Motzi Shemra, right?
Right. The defamer.
If we said that we could learn it already from the Motzi Shemra, so why, in the case of the Ones, does the Torah have to say it? We could have figured it out logically. So listen what they come up with. It says, "Eino inyon lefonov, k'neyu inyon liachrov." which means if it has no application beforehand, namely, we know then that on the basis of the comparison he must marry her. So apply it la'acharav. The fact is, when he tried to get rid of her by divorcing her, so now he has to do what? He has to take her back. Okay? She'im geirash, so that if he had divorced her, yachzir, he has to remarry her. Literally, he has to return her, you know, to,
right,
as his
restore
wife.
Her to,
as restore her as his wife, right. So now the Gemara says, Vakati, however, it says, Ones Mimotzi Shema Lo Gomar. It says, in reality, however, he is not learning the case of one from the other. Mm-hmm. Okay? The Ikal Mifrach, because we can turn the argument around. We can break the argument literally. Ma Lamotzi Shemra. What? Just as in the case of the Motzi Shemra, the guy who defamed his wife. Shekain lo keru mishalim, as I said before, inasmuch as the word the onshu implies more than simply a monetary fine, but it means also that he gets malchus, right? Correct? So he is lo ker, he gets malchus umishalim, and he has to pay money anyway, even though he gets malchus. Right?
Wait a second, this is in the Fumish that he gets malchus?
No, but it's derived from the word the onshu. That's what I said a few minutes ago, that the word the onshu implies already that you know, it's more than just
punished.
That his punishment is money.
Now,
his punishment
is
also malchus.
This is in the onus, the case of the onus.
No, in the case of the Motzi Shemra.
Also in the case of the Motzi Shemra.
The case of the Motzi Shemra. We have to, that's why I say it's a good thing that we have the Chumash in front of us, so we can compare.
Right.
This is in reference, you know, to the Motzi Shemra. Okay?
Thank you.
All right. So, Ma the Motzi Shemra, Shekein Leike, Mishalein, in the case of the Motzi Shemra, he gets malchus, and he also has to pay a fine, right? Elayo Yomar, but the Torah doesn't have to say Lo Si Eli Isha the Motzi Shemra, right? In the case of the Motzi Shemra, it should not be necessary to say that also he has to hang on to her, that she remains his wife, right? Why? Because he says Veligmar Miones, because that I could have learned from the fact that if the Ones, there the Torah says, right, that he has to be, you know, that he has to keep her as his wife, correct?
Right.
So it wouldn't be necessary, but, you know, there's no, while there's monetary punishment, but there is no malchus in that case.
Right.
So all the more so then that we could learn one from the other. Okay, this is what he says. Well, digmor me ones. Let's learn, right? Ma ones she'eno loke mishalim, right? That just in the case of the rapist, that he does not get malchus and have to pay monetary fine. As we said, he pays money, but he doesn't get malchus, right? So Omar Rachmona, the Torah said, below Sieli Isha, that she has to be his wife, then in that case, Motzi Shemra, lo kol shekein. Then in the case of the Motzi Shemra, where definitely he gets both malchus and, you know, mammon, in other words, he has to pay the monetary fine and so on. So all the more reason that he also is stuck by having to marry her.
And never divorce her.
Right. The lama Neymar, and why then does it say? So he says, it may no inyan the Motzi Shemra. If it doesn't need application for the Motzi Shemra, then to Neyam inyan Leones, then that case applied to the Leones. Of course, we did just the opposite before. Now, it may no inyan the Tonov, if it's not to begin with, you know, because we know already that he has to marry her. So to Neyam inyan Leachrov, then apply it, you know, to the second action, namely that after he tried to divorce her, that he has to remarry her. So apply it to that.
You lost me completely.
Yeah.
What the first was that he can't send her away, and the second is
Velo Sieli Yisho, right, okay.
So it has to be...
Both of them say Velo Sieli Yisho, okay?
The first is already there.
Right.
The
question is, you know, why can't we really learn one from the other? This is really what they're trying to debate right now. Why can't we learn one from another? We could have, so we tried.
Yeah,
right, yeah, exactly. We tried. Try case number one. In other words, okay, the Motzi Shemra didn't do any physical action to her, right?
He just
defamed
her, right.
He defamed her.
He
and yet the Torah says he gets both Malkus and money as a spy. Right? That's the Motzi Shemra.
Okay.
All right. The Ones did physical harm to her.
Right.
And yet he doesn't get Malkus.
He has to
pay, but he doesn't get Malkus. Okay?
Now, what was the reason why the Motzi Shemra also gets Malkus? What was the reason for
Because the Torah uses the word the Onshu.
Onshu, right, right, right.
Okay? Right, right.
Yeah, I'm having difficulty with this. Okay, go ahead. Doesn't seem... All right, go ahead.
No, no, no,
no. There's a way out,
okay.
I'm sure. All right.
Way out. I'm not sure. I'm way out right now.
You say the original case in the audience where he doesn't have to bury her?
He has to marry. They both have to marry. Both of them have to marry. The question is, why can't I learn the fact that he must marry her and she has to remain his wife from one?
Right, one from the other.
Yeah.
That's it.
Are there two different interpretations?
Right.
Right.
And we say, you're right, okay, each one has a certain quality about it, okay, each case. Case number one, as we said, the Motzi Shemra gets Malkus in addition to paying money. Okay? The Ones only pays money and he doesn't get Malkus. Okay? But the fact that the Lo Siyele Isho, if it's stated in one, then we should be able to assume that in the other case
certainly
it applies.
The onus is the more lenient punishment, and he has to...
In this case, right.
He has to remain married to her, then certainly a for sure, which is, of course, your name.
Right, right,
the person
right.
gets the more severe punishment,
correct.
Which in this game is the...
Correct. It's not only
Motzi
fine
Shemra,
more money, but also he gets Malkus in addition.
Then he certainly would have
so
to...
So he certainly married. Should... be forced, you know, to marry her.
That I understood. It's the second,
right.
the obverse that
right.
bothered me.
And the obverse, okay, is the fact that in one case, you know, okay, the Torah maybe will specify in the case of the, let's say, the Ones, that Velo Siyele Yisho, okay? So why do I have to have it in the case of the Motzi Shemra? Can't I learn it, you know, from the case of the Ones, because the Motzi Shemra is a more, you know, it's a more severe punishment, so all the more so. If it's true in the easier one, it should be also
true
in the harder case.
Right.
But of course, at this particular point, as we see, they're coming to a conclusion that you cannot really make a case of one based on the case of the other. But assuming that we can, then the Lo Siyele Yisho, it could also be applied. Why should it be there in the first place? If we say that it's superfluous since we could have learned it from the other case.
Right.
So the answer is that if it ain't no inyan lefonov, in other words, if you don't have to learn it for what happens in the first case, namely that the Torah says that he has to marry her, so to nail inyan le'acharov, then in that case, apply it to where he tries to get rid of her by divorcing her. Mm-hmm. Where the Torah says, hey, you can't do such a business because below Siyele Yisho means that you have to marry her after you've been given a divorce. Except, as we said, in the case of the Kohen, you can't do it.
Right.
Okay. All right. I think we'll stop at this point and let it marinate.
Okay. It's harder, right?
Marinate.
We'll continue next
good
week.
Good words.
Which word actually do you know that we left off?
We are on
the same in Lacharov, right?
Okay, yeah, all right.
So we're on Tesvav.
Yeah, or on Tesla. We'll review again some of this just in order to get the trend on it.
Yeah.
But at least we're following now that it's becoming clearer to us. To me too.
So we'll meet again on
what's
Mars.
What's happening over here?
It's a very good idea.
13th.
Right. And then right. So let's start. Okay, you want to review a little bit what we said last? All right. As I said, the business about the fun of the Akrav, it actually occurs twice on the page. But I think we got down to the second case. Or did we?
No, we only do the first case. Yeah,
you know what? Let's go very briefly, beginning at the beginning of this argument where it says about Ula. Okay?
Yeah, Ula, right.
Ula, okay. Where is Ula? Ula's up there someplace. I'll tell you.
Ula.
Yeah. Okay, right. In other words, according to Rabbi Yochanan, right, this is a case also, you know, that he should get Malkus because, you know, he did something which was negative prior to affirmative. In other words, he violated the affirmative, okay?
Right.
The affirmative says that you have to marry her. He violated it.
By divorcing her.
By divorcing her, right? So, again, we say then that he should get Malkus because even if he does marry her again, which is what the Torah says, except in the cases we said, you know, if he's a Kohen, he's not allowed
to.
Then in that case you should still get Malkus, right, according to Rabbi Yochanan.
Right.
So Omer Ula, so Umo, okay, you see where Ula is? Omer
right.
Ula. Yeah. Omer Ula, that's at the end of about 8 lines down.
Right.
So
right.
Okay. Omer Ula, it says, Lo Yomar, the Torah shouldn't say, Lo Tiyeli Yeshua, you know, these words that she shall be his wife, in other words, he has to marry her, but Ones, in the case of the...
The
rapist, right? The Ligmar, why can't we learn it instead? The Motzi Shemra, from the case of the Motzi Shemra. Ma Motzi Shemra, just as in that particular case, Shalei Oso Masa, he didn't do an actual act of violation. As we said, slandering somebody is not a physical violation. Sure, it's absolutely a moral violation that's prohibited, but it's not a physical one. So he didn't do something physically. And yet, Omer Rachmona, the Torah says, Velo Tiyeli Yisha, right, that she has to be his wife. So Ones, in the case of the Ones, where what he did, it was a physical thing, so Lo Koshigin, all the more so, you know, that he must marry her. Right? And then Eino Inyon Lefonov, and if it doesn't work, if it's not necessary to state that to begin with, and by to begin with, in other words, that he has to marry her, obviously, he marries her. Okay? Bezdin says, you marry her. So, Taneu in Yonayachrov, in that case, apply it to subsequently what happened. He divorced her, contrary to what the Torah had to say. And so now the Torah says, hey, you're not getting away so fast. You gotta marry her. Lo ti elisha means that you gotta marry her even if you divorced her. Sheim gerash, that if he had divorced, then yachzir, he has to remarry her. So they say, Varkati, nevertheless, still at this particular point, Ones, Mimotzi Shemra do Gomar. He didn't learn, you know, like a Kal V'chomer or something.
Yeah.
He didn't learn it from a comparison of the Motzi Shemra to the case of the Ones. He didn't learn it. Why? The Ikar L'Mifrach, because you can break this comparison by saying, hey, while A and B are equal in both cases, but C is different from, let's say, D in the other case or something like that. You understand? So that it's not a perfect comparison. As they say, Malamotzi Shemra, just as in the case of the Motzi Shemra. Why isn't a perfect comparison? Because Shekain Loke Umishalim, right? Because in his case, he not only gets Malkus, but he also has to pay, as we said before. Whereas the Torah did not specify this in the case of the Ones. So therefore, we cannot learn
this on the basis of pure comparison.
So according to what you're saying,
huh?
The onus pays too.
The onus pays, but he doesn't get malchus.
He pays more. As a matter of fact, doesn't he?
No.
One pays 100, one pays only 50.
Yeah, right, right. The Moshe Shemra pays more.
Right.
Yeah.
Moshe Shemra pays more.
Right, right. The Moshe Shemra pays more. Right. And, the
and he gets malchus in addition to that.
Absolutely.
And but the guy who's a rapist, well, he marries her. That's all.
Correct, but he also has to give 50 shekels to father but because of the fact that he violated the virgin.
Though. He never divorced her, though. The rapist never
Hold it. He marries her too. Okay, both of them, obviously the Beis Din says, pal, you got to marry.
I know.
All right, good. But then what happens? Then what happens is that he gets it into his head, he doesn't like her, and he divorces her. Okay?
Oh, I see.
He divorces
her. But he is known as a rapist.
Yeah. Okay, but you know, in time, look, I mean, how many hillbillies were married with shotgun marriages? Not necessarily hillbillies, but in lots of countries we know it happens, right?
No hillbillies among the Jews.
Well, there was Shechem and Dina. They almost were married. Almost were married.
Well, yeah.
Didn't quite work out that way.
He wanted. He wanted to get married.
Right. He paid the penalty, though.
Yeah, he really got malchus.
he got a caper.
Malchus multiplied, right?
Correct.
So now they say, all right. You say that you cannot learn ones from Moshe Shemra because of the fact that the Moshe Shemra has a double penalty, that he gets malchus and he has to pay, right? So it says, Ela lo yomar. All right, so let's make it the other way. The Torah shouldn't find it necessary to state what? Lo tiyeli yisho, that, you know, he has to marry her. B'motzi shemra, in the case of the motzi shemra, because v'ligmor me'ones, why can't we learn it logically, let's say, from the case of the ones, the case of the rapist, by saying as follows, ma'ones, just as in the case of the ones, she'eino lokem shalim, that he doesn't get malchus, just has to pay. And Omar Rachmonan, still the Torah said, "Velo tiyeli yisho," that he must marry her. So Moshe Shemra, lo kol shekein. Then certainly the case of the Moshe Shemra should require, you know, that he must marry her and he can't divorce her, right? Elomane mar. So why then is it necessary to state in both particular cases below the other Yeshua, right? If it's superfluous over here, because we would say that he has to marry her, since obviously this is a more severe case of what he inflicted, right? So he says Emeno Inyan the Moshe Shemra. So if it's not necessary to apply it to the Moshe Shemra, you know these words, because we already can learn it from what? From the Ones, right? So Taneu Inyan Leones, in that case, so apply it to the Ones. Imeno Inyan Lefonov, then Taneu Inyan Leachvav. If it doesn't apply to the initial marriage, because the Beis Din is going to see to it, you know that he gets married, so apply the words below to Yehuda Isha to what happens subsequently if he gets into his noodle to divorce her, in which case the Beis Din comes along and says, pal, you gotta take her back in marriage again because you're not allowed to. Okay? And still, why don't we apply it this way to say that, you know, the words of Lo Tiyeh Le'isha is superfluous in one case and so on. Motzi Shemra Me'ones Nami Le'gomar, right? And you cannot say that you can learn the case of the Motzi Shemra from the Ones. The Ikon Mifrach, because you can break the argument by saying, Maliones, look, how can you say that it's a perfect parallelism, right? In the case of the Onesh Kain, also Masa, right, he did something physical to her. Obviously, when he raped her, he did something physical, whereas the Moshe Shemra didn't. Elo, but rather what? Lo Yomar, let the Torah not say, Lo Siyeli Yisha B'Moshe Shemra. In the case of Shemar Rimmon, Share Ishtohi, look, she's his wife, so why does it have to say it again? So, Loma Nehemar. Hello? Yes? Question? Moshe Shemra is the man who slanders his wife by saying that she was not a virgin when he married her. And so the parents come to the Beis Din and they say, here we can show you proof that she was a virgin. Okay?
Phil, on the other hand,
yes.
Since he's bothering me about the rapist, okay?
Right.
The rapist is declared a rapist by the Beis Din, right?
Yes.
I mean, how else are they going to find out that he's a rapist?
Yeah, right.
No,
well, I mean, the parents of the girl, obviously, are going to scream bloody murder.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why. So they
goes to the
Beis
Din, and he slept to the Beis Din.
Right.
Does he get punished at that point?
Yeah, they say,
okay,
your punishment is A, you got to marry the girl, and B, you got to pay this girl's father 50 shekels.
Okay. All right. Now,
he
decides... He doesn't like her anymore.
Right.
He wants to see if he can get out of it.
Right.
Sneak out of the marriage, and he sues for divorce.
Correct.
He divorces her. How he gets a divorce, no one knows. But I mean, after all, she knows she's been raped.
Right. You asked a good question. How does he?
Yeah.
The answer is, today, our procedure for divorce is much more strict. But technically, in those days, it would be possible if either he writes a get or he has somebody write a get for him, he hands it to her, and automatically she is divorced.
She has to accept it?
In those days, she had to accept it. Today we don't work on that.
I see. Okay. Now
okay?
I understand.
You would think that it would be like a masa bedin or hashtag ila or hashtag. In other words, what court did he go to get the divorce?
If he went
to the same court,
they would have had it in the
record.
He
didn't
go to court. He said he wrote it himself.
He asked them and so on, right? And naturally, there were witnesses who signed the fact that this is a get of the,
They may not
get,
know the
okay?
truth.
It's a bill of divorce, right?
Between the two people.
And he hands it to her, and automatically, this means that she is divorced. Now,
what
could she do? The answer is she can come, say, to the Beis Din and say, look,
he raped me.
Number one, right.
It's a matter of record.
In this particular case, she would tie in as follows. He raped me. Torah says that he's not allowed to divorce me.
Right.
And the Beis Din will say to him, marry her.
Again.
Not allowed to marry her again, right. Unless he's a Kohen.
Yeah.
In which case, then, what would be his punishment?
Malchus,
the Beis Din will say, you get Malchus, because you can't undo the fact, you can't remarry her, but you violated a law in the Torah that says you're not allowed to, lo ti eli yisha, so you get Malchus as a punishment.
Yeah, but see, she would say three things. She would say, he raped me.
Right.
The Torah says that he's not allowed to divorce me.
Right.
And you judges, when you gave the original Pesach Din, you also said he's not allowed to divorce
Correct.
Me.
Correct, absolutely so. Right.
Right. So
period of time and for how long was this sort of unilateral divorce allowed?
No, okay. This was in effect in Talmudic times. Let's face it.
Mm.
This was in effect.
Where?
But in the days of the Talmud, this was in effect, okay? That it could be so. That a man could divorce his wife by simply giving her a bill of divorce, right? And, signed by the witnesses that this was a genuine document of divorce. Now, of course, he wasn't finished at that particular point, because she had a right to go to the Beis Din and say, okay, he divorced me, but I want my ksuba.
Right. Of course.
I want the monetary settlement, that he promised in case, he divorces me.
Right.
Because ksuba is in case of divorce or in case of death. That, he owes this amount of money to her, or his estate owes this amount of money to her. Okay? Naturally, if the get is challenged on the basis that it wasn't properly written or something, so that, then the Beis Din, of course, would have to come and to examine the document, and they would have to see whether the witnesses who signed were reputable people or they were not reputable people, and so on and so forth.
Let me ask you a further question, a little technical.
But I just want to finish one second.
Yeah, sorry.
This was theoretically the situation which existed, for a long time. However, in the days of Rabbeinu Gershon, who lived in France roughly about the year 1000 or something like that.
Said you can only marry one wife at a time.
So, right. Not only did he say that, that he could only marry one wife at one time,
which the Svarim, by the way, never accepted. I mean, because until recent times, you know, once they got to Israel, then they were already subject to Israeli law. But prior to that, when they were living in Muslim countries, let's say, they could marry more than one wife if they were, if they wanted to. Okay, but that was one of the things. But he also, you know, said that you cannot. A woman has a right, you know, to refuse a divorce, you know, if she feels that it's justified to do so. So that already changed the whole picture of divorce. A man cannot divorce his wife against her will.
Assuming that let's say this fellow who raped her,
yeah,
decides to divorce her, hands her the get, okay,
right.
Gives her the money,
yeah,
which she accepts, right? She takes the money.
If she takes the money, then technically
she's accepted the divorce.
Yeah, but it won't work that way. I'll tell you why. You're not allowed to do something which is in contravention, you know, contrary to a law of the Torah. Okay? So even if she would accept the money, that doesn't mean, you know, that he has the right, that it's a legal divorce.
Okay.
It would still have to be contested and reversed, okay? And either she'll give him back the money or she'll say, okay, look, he gave me money and it's his tough luck.
Talk about the car. She'll
put it in the cash.
Assuming that the woman is single or virgin, how about if
he
raped a married woman?
Oh, if he rapes a married woman, he's liable to the death penalty for doing that.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. If it's done in the presence of witnesses, okay? And they warned him that what he's doing is a violation of Torah, and they get the death penalty. If not, then they'll devise another penalty for him. But according to the law of the Torah, I mean, a rape of a married woman is no question. I mean, that's punishable by death. Even seduction of a married woman is punishable by death. You know, assuming, as I said, you know, that, you know, they were warned, there were witnesses, the witnesses warned, and so on and so forth, okay? Because otherwise, as we learned, you cannot inflict a death penalty without hasra, right? In other words, warning of the witnesses, right?
All right. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, listen, I mean...
No, it's kind of interesting, this business about if he gives her money, but she doesn't receive the get, whether it's valid or not.
Yeah, right. It would make it, you know, retroactively valid. It would not. Because you cannot do something which is contrary
to the laws of the Torah.
Right. So the Torah says, "Lo tiyeh liyishon," and that means "Lo tiyeh liyishon."
Let me ask one further question.
Sure.
What if she doesn't want to remain married to him? What happens then?
Can she divorce him?
No.
A woman cannot divorce a man, except in the days of the Torah. I mean, the days of the Talmud.
Of course not.
No. In the days of the Talmud, there were certain reasons for which a woman could come to the Beis Din and say, "I want you to make this man write me a bill of divorce." She didn't like, for example, the kind of work that he did. No, he stank all the time.
Yeah.
She couldn't stand his odor or something like that. She could come to the Beis Din and say, I need a bill of divorce. I can't live with this man. Okay? There were. Today, you know, you can't do it exactly on that basis. You can't. Because with divorce, unfortunately, a divorce which is given under compulsion is what we would call get me'useh. In other words, the guy was forced in order to give it. It's not recognized as being a legal get. A get has to be given. Get me'useh. Me'useh. Right, like the word oser, right, except that this would be the pu'al form, okay?
Oser.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah, so neither he can be compelled, nor can she be compelled. All you can do is to use moral suasion. Now, this wasn't always true, you see. In the days of the Talmud, and even in Europe, you know, to a somewhat more recent time, it was possible for the Beis Din to
to grant the divorce.
To give him a poor clap in order to persuade him, you know, to do that which is right and give the divorce. And as the Talmud would say, kofin oso, they force him. Ad sheyomar, until he says, rotza ani, I'm willing. So that he's still, technically, he's willing to give the divorce. But the fact that they used a little persuasion on him, okay, so today the only persuasion that you could use is moral persuasion. Well, this is why we have certain problems. I mean, all you have to do is to look at the Jewish press every week. Right, and you know, you see a list of some people, either men who refuse to give a get, or once in a while a woman who refuses to accept a get.
So in other words, a Jewish get today means both parties have to acquiesce to.
Correct. Both he and she have to be willing.
Yeah.
And you cannot use compulsion, except, you can, as I said, you could use moral suasion, but not compulsion, in order to affect it.
In Israel, they certainly have techniques they can use. They don't whip the people anymore.
That's correct.
A lot of things they
can. Yeah, I mean, only in recent times are they talking about such things as, for example, confiscating the driver's license,
passport,
and things like that, in order to get the guy
from occupations.
Pardon me?
They passed a new law. You can prohibit a person from occupations. You can prohibit him from being accountant or a lawyer or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You can prevent him from having a job in the government.
Yeah.
Of course, they always have the right to imprison, though. I don't know how effective that was.
They
had somebody
in jail
for 30 years.
He simply refused. He hated her so much that to him, jail was a refuge.
Somebody mentioned that rebuilding council
I've heard that too.
Today it's not allowed. Okay.
What are you saying?
That a recalcitrant man could be beaten up.
No.
I don't think he means by the bed scene. He means informally.
I heard it's happening.
It might have been used.
Well, I guess if you could get a mafioso or something like that.
Yeah, private detective.
Jewish
really
thing.
Wear a mask.
If you don't agree, so you find yourself with a kneecap shattered or something.
We've done that too. Okay.
No, I've heard the same thing. I read something that there are these private detectives in Israel who are, you know, basically strong-armed fellows that they'll go to a place like Italy or Starkers, they go to a place like Italy or even Romania or whatever, and if they try to get the man to sign a gift,
right?
And they use, I mean, sometimes they use arguments, sometimes money, but occasionally they use physical force as one of their methods. This is what,
but that's strictly speaking,
can't be a
is
very
prohibited because,
yeah,
as I said, that he has to, the final analysis to say, Rotza ani, I agree, I'm willing to do it, on my own free will and accord, you know.
And
as a matter of fact, I mean, in giving a gift, you have to ask, this is part of the procedure, you have to ask, are you doing this of your own free will?
Right.
And the same thing with the woman, you have to ask her, are you accepting this of your own free will, and so on. But otherwise, you know, you cast a doubt on the validity of the gift.
Yeah, I want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
I guess I'm wasting my time. Hey, I'm curious about this. I found this very, statistics didn't really bother me. But does the husband and wife have to be physically present in front of the Beit Din? Or can they do it like they do in the United States,
by
proxy?
That's a different story. The answer is, it's best if both parties are present, but it's not absolutely obligatory. We have a case, several cases, where, for example, let's say the husband came to the Beit Din, the Vada Rabbanim in Boston.
Right.
They wrote a get over there, and then they shipped it to the Rabbi of Kadim, whoever it was. I mean, could be Sadochine, could be Rosenzweig.
Right.
Could be Weisvogel, you understand?
I understand.
Okay. And the Beis Din over there has to appoint a shaliach locally, although it could be from Boston too, but a shaliach who will convey the get to the woman in the presence of a Beis Din locally. Understand?
Interesting.
No, once she accepts it, then that's it. Then she is divorced. So well, that has happened several times in my own experience. Okay?
Okay.
All right. As we say in French, le magin d'ail.
Le magin d'ail.
Right.
All right. So,
okay.
Yeah. So we say, Ela lo yomar, right? So let not the Torah say, lo tiyel yisha b'mosi shemra, in the case of Mosi Shemra. Sharei ishtohi, look. Soon as he libeled her, she's already his wife. Obviously, he married her to begin with. When did he come and say, you know, that she wasn't a virgin? After he'd already married her. So she is his wife. So in that case, why does the Torah have to say, lo tiyel yisha? Right? Loma ne'emar. So it says, Meinu inyan lemotzi shemra. So if it has no application to motzi shemra, then Teneu inyan leyonis. And in that case, let's apply it to the case of the yonis. The yin meinu inyan lefonov. And if it doesn't, it's not a